Well, we continue to look at the subject of Christian graces and virtues. And we've been looking at love. And this morning, we're looking at loving our enemies. Loving our enemies. And that is the title of the sermon. And we can see, of course, this in Luke chapter 6, as we read it a moment ago. But I say to you who hear, love your enemies. And again in verse 35, but love your enemies. And so we think of this difficult subject, difficult and challenging subject. And when the Lord taught, he did not teach this as though people would simply nod comfortably. And all the things that he said in that passage we read a moment ago would be received by them as something, yes, we can do that, like ticking the box, yes, no problem, no problem. No, these were very provocative words, designed there to search their hearts, to think about their relationships and how they sustain, keep those relationships and what those relationships consist of. So, loving our enemies seem to be almost mutually exclusive categories, love for and enemies. So let's think, first of all, my first heading is different kinds of enemies. Different kinds of enemies. I'm sure we could spend all week thinking about different kinds of enemies that there are out there. But let's consider a few basic sort of groupings as best we can in the time we have. And the first is enemies of the church. Enemies of the church. Not to us personally or specifically, but whose writings and words are levelled at the church in general. They may have a few particular people in mind where they level those accusations and charges against the church, but they are enemies of the church in general. They're not people that write to you and to me specifically, and railing against you and me specifically for our Christian convictions, but their writings are designed there to be an address to the whole church in general. Well, of course, they mean harm. They definitely do. They mean harm. And they would be very pleased if places like this were closed down and the Bible was sort of excluded, other than a piece of antiquarian literature with nice language, as it were, that we need to just preserve as part of our tradition. But believe it, no, we're not to do that or follow its teachings, definitely not. And so they very definitely mean harm to the church, to the gospel, to the Bible, well, to God himself. We can think, can't we, in the book of Nehemiah, of Sanballat and Tobiah. And we think of their opposition to the building of the wall, the rebuilding of the wall, and the Nehemiah's governorship, and the assistance there of all the willing hands that rallied to the call. Well, they try to stop it by all means, fair and foul, by invitation, and then by threats and intimidation and writing to the authorities. Nothing new is there under the sun. These atheists are writing to the government, complaining about this and complaining about that. Well, they are like Sanballat and Tobiah in the Old Testament. Writers, some of them are broadcasters and media figures. Various places of prominence that they can exercise their efforts to harm the church. And of these people, sad to report, of these people, often we can characterize them with words like this, that they're unteachable. They're unteachable. You can bring evidence, good evidence, say, for creation. Not hearing it, not listening to it, won't interact with it. That they are unreasonable. That they will take, as it were, extreme things that we would repudiate as Christians and say, most certainly, that's Christ taken out of that version of Christianity, and would caricature and set up what we call straw men. They'd be very unreasonable. When you try to, perhaps as people do, engage them on that, oh, they don't change. They carry on. Very unwilling. some, we have to say, are very perverted, very perverse. The means that they stoop to in what they say, and their language is rude and offensive, and they act there in a way to almost aim to misrepresent people and assert things of people who are Christians that are simply not true. Christians I know, none of those things are even remotely true. So there they are, enemies of the church in a broader sense. And to those, I guess we must also add, Islamists and such people who actively are pursuing their damage to the church. We learn, don't we, in West Africa, in the aftermath of the Charlie Hebdo publishing the further image of Muhammad, that there were riots on the streets and burning downs of churches. Well, there we are, enemies of the church. And then there are enemies who are personally our enemies, sadly. People who set themselves personally against us. And they can be very direct, very covert. But in one way or the other, they do not desire our good. They are not looking for our good, as we defining love there through the weeks. That desire for our well-being and of our safety and of our enjoyment of these things. No, they are set against that. They do not desire that for us. No, they perhaps rather wish our failure, or wish that we may end up looking stupid, or that we may lose in various ways credit in the eyes of others. They wish that we won't succeed in things, and at the worst, of course, they're carried through to most awful ends. They could wish us ill, and sick, or even dead. They could. They could wish such a thing as those who are very hardened enemies might be. Now, sometimes people merely harbour those thoughts in their hearts, simply look on there with a jealous eye or an angry look. But they're not doing anything to promote that. But of course, other enemies do. They're active. They're working to secure, they hope, some failure, to block our progress in some way, to go about some way there of diminishing us. And they're very active in it. And that is very, very sad when that takes place. They may try to hasten some decline of ours or add to some difficulty or grief that we have. Well, of course, there's, again, nothing new under the sun. The psalmist knew the work of enemies like that on various occasions. Psalm 35 as an instance in verses 15 and 16. But he says, in my adversity, as you see, just explaining before how he's always caring about people, even his enemies. Now, good example, but now what do? But in my adversity, they rejoiced, gathered together. Attackers gathered against me, and I did not know it. They tore at me and did not cease. With ungodly mockers at feasts, they gnashed at me with their teeth. What a thing. That was it. They rejoiced when he had hard times, when he wasn't well, or when he had come against some frowning providence. They rejoiced at it. What a thing. That was what he experienced. So in Psalm 55, in that regard, in verses 20 and 21, he has put forth his hands against those who are at peace with him. He has broken his covenant. The words of his mouth were smoother than butter, but war was in his heart. His words were softer than oil, yet they were drawn swords. There's nothing worse than that, is there? An enemy there who kind of disguises himself as a friend, if you like. And he always thinks there, doesn't he, of Judas Iscariot looking forward to how he would come. Betray his master there with a kiss at the last, all looking very much full of thought there, of the care, of the well-being of the soul of somebody, but actually no, behind it all, his words, though smoother than butter, war was in his heart. His words were softer than oil, yet they were drawn swords. So that particular enmity. Well, it's sad to report sometimes in the church, Christians or professing Christians can so set themselves against another that they are virtually enemies to each other, desiring there the downfall or some calamity upon another person. That is terrible, very critical and uncharitable and snarling and downright nasty to each other. Glad to be able to report that we don't have that, do we, here? But nevertheless, you hear stories, incredible stories, church meetings that degenerate into the most awful kind of slanging match there and insults that are traded. And that is very, very sad and demeaning to the cause of Christ. Well, we won't dwell there, because, of course, enmity primarily directed against us personally is from non-Christians. Non-Christians, unregenerate people. People that know nothing of the power of grace working in their lives. Non-Christians. Well, why does this happen? Well, lots of reasons, of course. Here are just a few. They may just take a dislike to us. A sort of irrational dislike to us. Before we've almost even said anything, they dislike us. Perhaps in work we've taken a position that they wanted. And we got it in an interview process or something, and they didn't get the promotion they wanted. So just ipso facto, just as a reason there because of that, they hate us. They dislike us. They would have us there fail utterly in post, and they might even go about making that to happen. Well, it may not be anything we've done, any skill that we excel in, or some particular gift or talent that creates there a sense of jealousy or inferiority or something. It might just be how we speak. Just how we speak, they don't like that. Our accent come from the wrong place. Or our appearance. That in and of itself there generates a dislike, a hostility. Whether expressed, whether it's behind a smile, but actually there's a drawn sword there and an enmity bubbling away inside. But whichever way, maybe just because of that, they dislike us. Something about our character. We may be outgoing, we may be quieter people, but something about that generates their reaction against us. That can be quite irrational and extraordinary. It can happen within families. And it can happen within work situations. It can happen within society in general, places that we meet with people, societies and gatherings, wherever there are groups together. That kind of dislike, plainly and obviously for rational reasons, like your shape, your size, of course sometimes it comes out as your race or something like that, comes to the surface, and that's awful. We see it, don't we, there? And anti-Semitism that we learn is quite strong in our country. That is awful. And these kinds of things there are most irrational and wrong. And of course, then they may dislike us because we're Christians. Because we're Christians. That, of course, feeds into the kind of character we may have and the kinds of things we do, and maybe our hard work and diligence over and against their sloth and laziness, or our reasonable treatment of people and fair-handed way we deal with people compared to them. But yes, our Christian convictions and the Christian behaviour that follow from it lead to difficulties. They react against it. And so they may gossip about us, mightn't they? They do that kind of thing. They gossip about us behind our backs and pull down our characters or ridicule us. Maybe then carry it out to our face and criticise us and in various ways there try to make us look stupid, even insult us. Insult us personally or insult the God in whom we trust. Trying to harm our credibility, our social stock and standing. To take from us our well-being, our peace, bullies at school, this kind of thing, trying to stop us feeling comfortable and at home. They want to take that away from us so that we feel we are surrounded by enemies and we're inferior people and that we don't belong there and that you're not welcome here. And this is what they delight to try to produce. And of course, this as well is very familiar territory. The Lord himself warned of such things in John 15 and verses 18 to 19. Here we read, if the world hates you, you know it hated me before it hated you. If you are of the world would love its own. Yet because you are not of the world, but I chose you out of the world, therefore the world hates you. shows you out in the world. You're distinct. There's something different now about you and your direction and your aims and purposes. And the world knows that. It knows that you're not just aiming for this life, that you're looking beyond it. You're looking for that reward at the end. You're seeking something higher and better. And that's provocative to the world. It hates that. It's a reminder to them that there is eternity and a judgment. They loathe the very thought of that, and their reaction comes out in this way, that they may very actively hate us and set themselves against us. So there are some different kinds of enemies, and there are different degrees and intensity of enmity, severity of it, willingness to express it or just to harbour it. And we need to realise that. We need to realise that. We need to know, growing up in this world, we need to know that people out there, their words can be smoother than butter, but actually within their heart there's enmity that's being harboured. And we mustn't be surprised if that sometimes comes out. And we mustn't be shocked that people respond like that, but think, the book tells us about that, doesn't it? And if it's our Christian convictions they're reacting to, the book very much tells us about that. And don't be thrown by it. Or don't feel as if the problem must be with me in this. No, stand firm. Stand confidently in this. If it's the Lord who's working in you, praise God for it. Thank God that he's made you, as it were, worthy to be seen in this way. And that something in you has been recognised in this way as to provoke this kind of reaction. We might need, basically, to be tougher as soldiers in this battle and be able to weather a few of these blows. So different kinds of enemies. Well, my next heading is this. Love tries to avoid making enemies. Love tries to avoid making enemies. And in this, there are a few points that we can perhaps make. So love, you see, we don't like to make enemies. So we seek not to make enemies in the first place. And sometimes, of course, the enmity can be in our head. We imagine it of other people. We can imagine it of other people. And so my first point to make here is distinguish enemies from critical friends. Distinguish enemies from critical friends. Now, this is a big phrase within education, a critical friend. That's what governors are meant to be to the poor head teacher, a critical friend. Well, we underline the word friend in this. Whatever they do, if they're doing their job properly, it's being a friend. They're looking actually to be helpful. They're looking towards the good of the person and not to have some enjoyment at saying something there that they're not going to like, or tearing down their character, or assassinating something of their character in that way. See how the psalmist received it in Psalm 141, in verse 5, which we read earlier. Let the righteous strike me, it shall be a kindness. Let him rebuke me, it shall be as excellent oil. Let my head not refuse it. There's a good critical friend there somewhere. The righteous. Let them speak to me in some way that, it doesn't make me necessarily happy, but it might be something I needed to hear, and I shall receive that as a kindness. It will be as excellent oil. It's going to have a curative property. It is going to bring me out in a more fragrant state. Let my head not refuse it. And so he distinguished there enemies from friends. No enemies would want to come and strike, but not in a way of kindness. That's just in a way of being malicious and destructive. The righteous there bring actually help in their words. Now, those words may wound at times. Their design actually is for our help and our encouragement and our improvement maybe in some regard or other. So we have to recognise sometimes we may interpret it as an act of enmity, but it's actually an act of love and friendship by that other person. We mustn't there too hastily in our minds categorise that person as an enemy rather than what we might just call a critical friend. Next in this regard, be slow to describe people as enemies. Be slow to describe people as enemies. Don't rush to that conclusion and that categorization. Give them time, perhaps, to demonstrate their enmity. And so in this regard, require evidence. Surmising is not enough. Sometimes we can conjecture and speculate about people who live in another nation somewhere there and what they're like and what they're not like. And then maybe when we go see them, they're completely different to what we imagine. So surmising is not enough. But over time, we may discern a pattern. Over time, we may see that there are features, a collection, a cluster of ways of behaving and thinking, ways of acting, that in one way or another indicate to us that even if they're not personally enemies to ourselves, they're enemies of the cause of Christ and the good and the well-being of the church. We look on and see over time a pattern, a trend, a sort of clustering there of ideas and actions and judgments that that person is making that indicates they're no help at all, that we may have to speak, we may have to interject something there. But love tries as long as possible to keep them on side until the evidence says, no, they're not. They're the wrong side of the line. They constitute here not those who are bringing good, but actually bringing harm to us. And so, for instance, in the church discipline process, it doesn't rush to a conclusion before it concludes that somebody is actually an enemy to the good of the church and her order and holiness and the glory of God. It gives people time there to change, time to bring them to their senses and see differently. In Matthew chapter 18, the way that it runs there and the appeals that can be made to that person. Moreover, we're told, if your brother sins against you, go and tell him his fault between you and him alone. If he hears you, you have gained your brother. You've done him good. You've rescued him. Your rebuke he has received there, like in the psalm earlier, it has been to him as that precious ointment. His head has not refused it. Well and good. Ah, but if he doesn't listen, well, it goes on, doesn't it? But if he will not hear, take with you one or two, that by the mouth of two or three witnesses, every word may be established. And if he refuses to hear them, tell it to the church. But if he refuses even to hear the church, let him beat you like a heathen and a tax collector. You must now consider him to be an enemy of truth, one who is not friendly towards good standards of behaviour and morality, one who does not adhere to orthodox Christian doctrine. You have to regard this person, this man, this woman now, as an enemy of the church. And sadly have to conclude that and place them then outside of church membership. So it makes appeals, tries, love is always seeking there to hear it, understand it better. But the limit is reached when some just persist in that way, are deaf to all appeal. So Titus 3, verse 10, reject a divisive man after the first and second admonition. If after that, still no change of heart, then they are to be rejected. They are constituting themselves enmities. They're unteachable, ungovernable, unreasonable. There's something, an unwillingness in them. And so the evidence is there. But the evidence has to appear, and the appeals, not just one, in a sense, not just two there, but you appeal until the time is reached. The evidence is so clear, they're not listening, and there you have to constitute them as being wrong side of the line. You're now an enemy of the church and good order. Guard against paranoia. I've already touched on this in a way. Guard against paranoia. Paranoia actually can be quite a big thing within the Christian church. You know, imagining demons here and great wars going on in the heavenlies and what's happening in all these places and what's going on in these different parts. Well, we can imagine enemies everywhere. Kind of attitude and mindset, of course, is not just within the Christian church. It can strike into cultures and countries there, phobias of one kind or another that are built on simply an imagined thing, a rumour some kind of idea that just gains currency and produces then a state of paranoia, an expectation that we have enemies everywhere, that they're out to get us, that we're facing all kinds of opposition. Maybe the opposition might have been there, but of a smaller scale. Or there are things happening, for sure there are things happening, the heavenly places, but we're not told all about those things there. For us, we have clear duties here upon the earth. Go and preach the gospel. And the disciples want to know, well, what about Israel? Is this now the nation going to come back to some full glory and into its state again of blessedness? Not for you to know what is appointed for different countries. You leave that alone. Go and preach the gospel. And similarly there, we can be quite paranoid about other nations, what they're doing, what's happening there. Well, I'm sure most of the time we don't know what's happening there. And some Christian authors purport to say, they know just what's going on here, they know just what's going on there. And evidence over time proves they haven't got a clue. And the books might be bestsellers at the time, but I think sometimes those best-selling books need to be dusted down after 20 years or so and reread back to these authors. And see whether they'll blush and maybe send out a better book next time saying, don't be as paranoid as I was. So don't overinterpret things. We can apply that now to a smaller scale. Overinterpreting gestures. What people are looking like, how they are responding to us or not. Don't overinterpret silences or absences. A person's absent, what does this mean? They've gone off in a huff here. What's happened? Well, sometimes it could be 1,000 reasons why they're not there, 1,000 reasons why they looked as they looked. And the mind can fill in explanations sometimes that just aren't valid. We can think of people there, but they're against us. Maybe they're just having a bad day that day. Or maybe some people just look more severe than others. You can see it, can't you, in films. People are selected, aren't they, there? Their face just looks severe. And so they're going to be, the judge or somebody like this. And other faces there just look rather comical. And so they're not going to be a serious character there. No. They get typecast, don't they? They have to play, some sort of light sort of character there. Somebody's going to be a bit funny. In real life, those people might be completely the other way around. And had you really known them, you wouldn't imagine that this severe-looking person there is a life and soul. And this funny-looking person here is actually a very sad, melancholy person. It's so often the case, isn't it, with comics? There they are, they make everybody laugh, and at home, they are the saddest people of all. People can just look a certain way, but it is no indication as to what's really going on inside their heads. And we can construe them as being enemies. Well, that's just how they're looking. Other people, by their temperament, can be different. Their temperaments, how they deal with things, how they react to things. And some people react one way and other ways there. Some people deal with a situation more brightly, others go into a more sort of solemn look about it. We have to accept that's how people often are, not think, that was a hard look there, they didn't take that very well there, or some such thing. Temperaments can vary. Or we might do something quite innocent that is mistaken by another person. Something, some word that we might say in an unguarded moment or an offhand comment or something like that, which wasn't really our deeper thought or that which we're given lengthy consideration to, and we take it amiss. We respond to this. That person now, we kind of regard them as our great enemies, and how that can often cause us personally great distress. We get to know the person better. Well, far from that. There was a different story all behind that. I remember, too, some people may be carrying very private pain or grief, something that they may not have communicated to everybody, but it's very real to them. And they're not going to be, quote-unquote, on form that particular day, not feeling well. They're in some preoccupation, some great and troubling matter that is taking up their energy and not granting them to have 100% focus on that conversation or on that particular piece of interaction. Sometimes we're just plain tired, aren't we? And that can be misconstrued as not caring for us or being a bit offhand towards us, and we can almost then sort of paint them as enemies. So we have to watch in that. And of course, between cultures, there's quite a lot of variety there in respect of how people facially may respond, how they look. And some cultures, perhaps you've noticed it. I've noticed it, I think, over the years enough now to be able to say I think there's a trend there. In some cultures, when you're photographed, you don't smile. You don't smile. You often see, I have done now, sort of groups of pastors, and they're not smiling. Well, okay, here in the West, we'd be more inclined to smile. You have these smiling faces looking back, and very often there, from overseas, they're not smiling at all. Well, they're very happy people, actually, very much enjoying the conference they've been at, but they don't smile. It's not done to smile for your photograph. And they can look there for all the world as if they've each of them had some most serious and terrible news delivered to them, that they're in the most happy situation in this gathering here. Actually, not at all. There, when you're photographed, you don't smile. And so we shouldn't look at this, be taken back by this, and think, what is this? It's just a cultural difference. But also, as love tries to avoid making enemies, ensure our own behaviour doesn't make enemies. Ensure our own behaviour doesn't create enmity in others, or needlessly give people opportunity to think ill of us, or of the church, or of the Lord. That, oh, some things that we might say that are most unwise, some careless and flippant words, some foolish words. Somebody there got in trouble in the press recently for comparing the justice that he felt to convicted rapist in the football game had not been given with the getting of justice for the Hillsborough victims. There was an outcry against this. What an inappropriate sort of comparison. What a way of comparing one thing with the other. It just doesn't work, that, and makes a mockery, really, of the seriousness and the tragedy of the 96 Hillsborough victims there, that football match that ended up in this crowd. Crush, you may be familiar with that. But it was an illustration there that was cack-handed, and you think, well, that's just caused very needless offence. Or, oh dear, we have to go for Richard Dawkins, don't we, there? But I will one of these days, there, forbear for mentioning. But there he is. One of his comments once, comparing, you know, paedophilia. There's less serious and milder paedophilia and more serious paedophilia. Well, what a gross thing to say, and a foolish thing to say. All paedophilia is awful. You don't want to make a kind of distinction and think a bit better of those people there than those people there. They're all wretched people there in that regard. Tasteless comparisons or just bad sense of humour. Sometimes just making something a joke, which really just isn't a joke at all. Cruel sarcasm. Sometimes our manner. Come across there too arrogant, all superior, all smug. Well, we need to just think about that and learn from a bit of negative feedback and implement change so that we're not needlessly creating difficulty for others and maybe making enemies, if you like, out of them. They shouldn't be becoming enemies, but sometimes they do. They've got to cut slack for each other, haven't we? But we regard and monitor our own actions to make sure there that we're not construing people, giving people the opportunity to produce that reaction against us. So, God willing, next week we'll continue to look at this subject of loving our enemies. As we've now looked at the whole matter of those enemies, and their kinds of attitudes towards us, and how we can avoid, in the first place, making enemies. Our love for our enemies, like a preemptive strike. Well, they're not enemies at all. We'll come to look at those who are true enemies of us in the church, God willing, next week.